You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. 6 months ago, life for Ukrainians unraveled into war. The Russian invasion, however, miscalculated the resistance they would face. An independent journalist based in Sacramento knew Ukrainian strength and resilience very well as the history of hard-fought turmoil and sorrow leading to their country's independence, which once again is in jeopardy. Martin Kuz is that journalist. His late father escaped Stalin's Soviet Union, becoming a refugee in the United States following World War II, and building a life that in many ways fits the traditional definition of the American dream. Martin returned to his late father's homeland in the days leading up to the war and shared his reporting, woven with his family history, into the recent issue of Sacktown Magazine and a spring edition of Christian Science Monitor. I spoke with Martin after he returned from his second trip this year to Ukraine. You have deep family ties to Ukraine. You arrived a few days before the Russian invasion began in February. You stayed through mid-March. But before we get into what you experienced and what you chose to share in your reporting, let's begin with your family history, especially with your father. It starts almost a century ago in 1923.
Right. My father was born in the city of Lviv in 1923. And at that time, Lviv actually belonged to Poland, but his parents instilled in him and his brothers a very strong sense of Ukrainian identity. And ultimately, Ukraine, that portion of Ukraine, was absorbed again into the Ukrainian state when the Soviet Union came into existence. And my father grew up at a time of extreme hardship and deprivation in Ukraine. When he was 10 years old, Joseph Stalin, then the leader of the Soviet Union, created essentially a man-made famine called the Holodomor that killed an estimated 4 million to 10 million Ukrainians. And I think that kind of acute suffering informed my dad's perspective on the difference between Ukraine and Russia. So when he took up arms for Ukraine, it was with the idea that one day Ukraine might be free and democratic and independent. And after World War II, he had been in a prisoner of war camp when the war ended. He knew that for taking up arms against Russia and the Soviet Union, that he would be executed if he ever returned. He and members of his unit were extremely fortunate. They were sent to England because they were in a British prisoner of war camp. And that gave him the opportunity then to pursue a different future from many of those who were sent back to Ukraine who faced exile or execution, which would have been his fate. He very likely would have been killed upon returning to Ukraine. And that set him on the path to the United States, but along with being able to pursue a new future, I think there was this great heartache for him that he was never able to return to his homeland. He never saw his parents again. He never saw his brothers again. And that notion of separation, of severance, I think cut so deep within him, even as he embraced everything about America and about all the opportunities that he found in the United States that would have been denied to him in Ukraine while under the rule of the Soviet Union. So long answer to your question, but that is part of the reason why I am so committed and deeply interested in what's happening in Ukraine.
A long but necessary one. Your father, Eugene, passed away in 2015 at 92 years old. And you mentioned he never again saw his parents or his brothers when he left Ukraine. And that was 70 years that he was gone until his death. You called him a spiritual citizen. You know, I mean, in America, he was free. He was also alone. And that community, that homeland, that identity is out of reach. Is there a collective sense of that here in Sacramento with Ukrainian refugees, kind of this sorrow that shapes a collective identity that you talk about in your reporting?
I think that the idea of living between worlds is something that sort of transcends time for refugees from any country who find themselves in a new land. And certainly here in the Sacramento region, I think that holds true for Ukrainians who have come here really post 1991. That's when Ukraine regained its independence. And after the collapse of the Soviet Union, you saw a surge of Ukrainians to the United States, to Europe as well. And now in Ukraine, when we look at this current invasion, which we actually have to step back about 8 years to 2014, when Russian-backed separatists seized a portion of eastern Ukraine, kind of laying the groundwork for what we're seeing today. And you saw a new surge of Ukrainian refugees to the United States and to the Sacramento region. And we're continuing to see more of that now. And I think that there is this this yearning, this desire to return home, even as there is a deep sense of relief at escaping the hardship, escaping war, escaping deprivation, and escaping fear. I think that is sometimes unstated, but there is within war such great fear from day to day. And to be able to separate from that, it allows you to, on the one hand, when you're settled here in the Sacramento region or elsewhere in the United States, I think to exhale and to appreciate that you've escaped that sphere of anxiety and of wondering whether this might be my last day. At the same time, it gives you the chance to consider all that you miss about your homeland, family, friends, neighborhood, food, culture, heritage. All of that is something that is now out of reach.
You mentioned a war before the war, and that's the Russian invasion of the East Crimea and the Donbass region back in 2014. Your father, he obviously immigrated to the United States, but there are Ukrainians who chose to stay behind, and you met them on your journey in your reporting. I was reading an article of yours in the Christian Science Monitor, and there were people that you met who essentially adapted to the confines of war from back in 2014, rather than leaving the life that they knew. Is that a common sentiment among Ukrainians who chose to stay behind?
I think what people confront with war is something that is beyond imagination. You cannot conceive of war until you're inside of it. It's so big. It's so destructive. And I look at this as a reporter, but I think it also reflects my reporting in Afghanistan and Ukraine, talking to people who find themselves caught in the maw of war, which is that how do you imagine a new future for yourself when you're caught in something that you had never conceived of previously? For I think many people, the decision is to simply try to persist and to stay and adapt within extraordinarily difficult circumstances. And you have familiarity of home, but you also have family ties. You have a common language, a common culture. You have perhaps a job, or you might be able to more easily find a job. And I think that, you know, when we're seeing now some of the Ukrainian refugees return to the country, even as it's at war, that is much of what motivates them to go back, is because abroad they find so much confusion and so much uncertainty. And the kind of cruel reality of war is that even when it appears your entire world is being ripped apart, it still somehow resembles that which you knew before. I think it has to be mentioned. You do have people who are also more sympathetic to Russia, more sympathetic to Russia than they are to Ukraine.
When you talk about that, I want to get to this analogy that you have when it comes to physical landscape and the size of Ukraine. You compare it to the size of Texas, which is a very big state. You know, from Kyiv to Luhansk is comparable to Dallas to Brownsville, which is on the border. I actually worked in Brownsville and McAllen, and it can feel a world apart. When you travel throughout Ukraine, when did you see those sentiments and those views kind of diverge or fork in the road?
it's an interesting point, in part because prior to 2014, there was much more ambivalence among Ukrainians about the Ukrainian government and about where their allegiance lie. And after that uprising, polls indicated that increasingly Ukrainians felt more strongly that Ukraine needed to remain free and independent, and that its future belonged really in the direction of Europe and Western Europe in particular. And so, for instance, in the Donbas, when I was traveling in that region in February, I did encounter people who had a kind of wistfulness for life under the Soviet Union, not because they had such great affection for that period of time, but because there was a kind of stability. And it may have been it may have been difficult. There was hardship, but there was a kind of consistency to it. Once the uprising occurred in 2014, and the Ukrainian government then had difficulty actually providing aid to that part of the country, and Russia was not really doing much to help people there, I think that's when the shift really started to occur, not only in the eastern part of Ukraine, but throughout Ukraine. It was this recognition that Russia, in fact, does present an existential threat to us, and we need to stand strong, and we may need to, in fact, fight for our freedom. So Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, I think, made a great miscalculation in believing that Ukrainians would take up the Russian cause when the invasion began in February of this year.
I want to go back to when you first arrived to Ukraine, because it was the days leading up to war. And it's easy to forget, given everything that's unfolding at the onset of a possible war, that many people, including the West, didn't think or were doubtful that an invasion would actually come to fruition. Given that you arrived days before that became a reality, was that a consensus among the Ukrainians you met, or even yourself?
Prior to the invasion, we heard the United States intelligence community in particular warning that an invasion was imminent. And yet I think there was great skepticism, not only within the West, but within Ukraine. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, up until a day or two before the invasion, insisted that an invasion was not imminent. In Donbas, the eastern portion of Ukraine, they understood war more so than the rest of the country because they had been living within war for 8 years. The people there had a kind of fatalism about the potential for a wider invasion. They had been living in the proximity of war for 8 years. And if more war was to come, they were resigned to the fact that their lives would become harder, but to some extent they had adapted to this extreme deprivation. And so with residents there, I didn't sense necessarily denialism. I sensed a kind of sort of hard-won fatalism. Troops in the eastern portion of Ukraine were clearly ready. And that was a dramatic difference from 2014, when the Ukrainian military was a largely volunteer force. It is now a professional fighting force, and as we've seen, a very effective and potent fighting force. When I spoke to residents in Kyiv, I think because of what you identified earlier, Vicky, which is this great distance between Kyiv and where the war was happening, I think there was an even a sort of greater kind of denialism, one might say magical thinking, that Kyiv would remain untouched by war. And part of that is, of course, wishing that war will never arrive, because who wants destruction and death? On the other hand, it was also just this great geographic remove from where this war had been going on for 8 years, and a sense that it was localized. You know, it's down there. And so I think when the war finally began on February 24th, residents in Kyiv, in some ways, I think were much more shocked than those in, say, eastern Ukraine, because I don't think they believed that war would come, and nor were they conditioned in a way that residents in eastern Ukraine were. And Kyiv then quickly emptied out of this the bustling metropolis of 3 million people, virtually overnight appeared to become a ghost town as people fled west away from the worst of the fighting at the start of the war.
During your 5 weeks there, you stood in the trenches of war yourself. I'm struck by a quote that you got from a sergeant saying, "This time it won't be us who is surprised." You, given that you were there, were you surprised by the resistance that Ukraine erected against a larger Russian military?
The 8 years of fighting in Donbas had shown how the Ukrainian military had graduated from kind of a ragtag collection of volunteers into a cohesive fighting force. But an invasion of the size that Putin unleashed on Ukraine has not been seen since World War II. And even if the same thing were to occur, say, against the United States, I think all of us would wonder, how is the military going to respond? But the questions, I think, ran even deeper into Ukraine simply because there were two great unknowns. One was the strength and capacity and effectiveness of the Russian military, and the other was the strength and the size and the effectiveness of the Ukrainian military. And I think both Putin and the West made miscalculations. I think both the West and certainly Putin himself believed that Russia would simply steamroll Ukraine. That first week, 2 weeks of the war was extremely crucial. And it was then, I think, that the Ukrainian military showed to the world, we're ready. We're ready, and we will show you that we are ready. And the Russian military has learned that lesson more so than anybody else.
I love that you also captured moments that can get left out during war reporting. A beekeeper that you wrote, he kept tending to bees despite the lack of business because it provided some respite and busied his mind. What are other examples that you can share about how Ukrainians are finding some respite, a healthy distraction while enduring war?
There was a couple that I met in eastern Ukraine, and this couple had taken it upon themselves to become a kind of ambulance service for the region. And I asked them about their commitment to their fellow Ukrainians and why they were risking their own lives, because shelling was still going on in those areas. Firefights would occasionally break out. And they said that the idea of helping our fellow Ukrainians helps us as much as it helps them. It gives us a sense of purpose. It creates a kind of routine in our lives. And we feel like this is something that can take our minds off of everything that we're facing, even as, well, you know, many times the patients that they were taking to the hospital because the clinics in their area had closed or had been shelled or the doctors had left for safer areas. So they would, many of those patients had sort of, you know, everyday health problems. They weren't casualties of war, but sometimes they did have to take soldiers in their little Lada, which is actually a Russian-made vehicle that is, if you remember a Volkswagen Rabbit, a Lada is even smaller. And so they would use that as their ambulance that they had painted and put a little siren on to take people to a hospital about 90 minutes away. And they simply did that because it seemed to them morally right, but it also created a kind of structure to their day-to-day lives. And other people that I met both at that time, prior to the invasion and right after the invasion, and now in June and July, talk about how a return to, quote, normalcy is so important because it enables them to momentarily forget about the difficult circumstances in which they live. On this most recent trip in June, I was in the northern city of Chernihiv, which is perhaps 90 minutes or so north of Kyiv. And I met a man who runs a deli. And his shop had suffered an incredible amount of damage, but he had repaired everything and he was back in business. And I said, why are you here? Why take this risk? Even though Chernihiv at this point is relatively safe, but war may come back, tanks may return. And he said for him there were two primary reasons. One was to provide jobs for his employees. He cared about them and he wanted to make sure that somehow they would earn a little bit of money so that they could provide for their families. The other reason for him was that it gave him a sense that he had reclaimed a part of his life that had been ripped away from him by war, by this Russian invasion. And I think that this decision that Ukrainians make to try to go back to something like a normal life is very much about reclaiming who you are and what you feel belongs to you. It's a kind of agency that war strips from its victims, from those who face the destruction of their everyday lives. And so that spirit burns very brightly within Ukraine. And that, I think, is something that Russia miscalculated, and to some degree, I think the West miscalculated. I don't think they understood just how much Ukrainians care about their country.
You're talking about a battle that happens far away from the trenches and is ingrained in Ukrainians' DNA and history. You know, when people were fleeing, some 6 million people that are now refugees outside of Ukraine, you also talk about the fact that they weren't piling on top of each other and pushing each other out of the way. There was this sense of a family and community, and you touch upon an envy and an irony from the West, given where you say, quote, where national identity continues to fracture and the concept of banding together for the common good appears extinct. When did you come to that realization or that comparison, given that, you know, you're here in California, but traveling to your father's homeland in Ukraine?
These trains that were headed west were overloaded. When I watched these scenes unfold, conductors were limiting exactly how many people could get on board. One sense that the conductors, if they could have taken an entire country on a single train, they would have done so. So there was compassion from the conductors, but even more striking was the calmness amid war that Ukrainians showed as they were trying to flee for their lives. Instead of people pushing each other on the platforms or elbowing each other to get on the train first, what I saw were younger Ukrainians helping the elderly or the very young to move up and down the platforms, to actually board the trains, people giving up their seats to those that they felt were more deserving. And in that moment, it was a recognition that this is the democratic ideal. This is the idea of people coming together for a greater purpose and not thinking principally about their own fate, but about the fate of those that they don't even know. And I was made aware of what felt to me like this enormous gulf between what we see in Ukraine and this banding together, this cohesion, and what we see in a country like the United States, which is fraught, tense. Civility and decency seem to be increasingly rare, just on an everyday basis. And I thought, how might the United States react if it were faced with a similar circumstance? I don't have any kind of clear answer any more than anybody else. But I did find myself thinking, I'm not so sure we would come together the way Ukrainians have, and that they continue on this most recent trip to Ukraine in June and the first part of July. I saw that none of that has changed.
Finally, I want to end with your father. You talk about how, you know, when your father immigrated to America, he had a choice, or made a choice, to be insulated, kind of walls of protection, given everything that he endured in his life. But that also may have prevented him the chance to heal. There are others who will follow in that path, following the trauma of war and displacement. What do you hope for this new generation of Ukrainian refugees?
I think that the new generation of Ukrainian refugees because of the world that we now live in, the digital connectivity, we'll have the opportunity to not only stay in greater, have greater connections with their homeland and with people who are still there, but also to find each other here and to recognize that they can have in the Sacramento area or in Southern California or in other parts of the country, a kind of little Ukraine, a place where they can share their stories, share their grief, share their trauma, but also celebrate their country and celebrate each other. I think to heal from the unseen wounds of war, you need the opportunity to be around your own simply because they understand you without you needing to actually say what it is that burdens you. My father was by nature reticent about his past, I think in part because of what he had learned growing up under the yoke of a totalitarian regime. And the Soviet Union sowed suspicion among the people in its republics. And I think even when my father came to the United States and had been here many years and had created a new life for himself, I think that suspicion lingered. What is difficult for us to conceive here in America is the loss of everything that you know and that you cherish. And that was certainly my father's experience. And through strength of will, he was able to rebuild his life and his future. For Ukrainians coming here today, they face a similar circumstance, but I hope that they can find not only strength among their own, but also feel from the rest of us this idea that we are here for you and we will help you. And that includes myself.
Martin, thank you for sharing your journey and your family.
Vicki, it's been an honor and a privilege. Thank you so very, very much for welcoming me on the show.
That is my conversation with Martin Kuz, an independent journalist based in Sacramento. You can read Martin's journey to Ukraine in the recent edition of Sactown Magazine. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.